They know you know you're here if you're in this, you're in the right place.
Okay, so, boy, you guys are great. I wish I had a class that got quiet like this. So, thank you so much for joining us today here in the Smith Stone Center. This is the, tomorrow actually is the 15th anniversary of what was Sunsight, then MetaLab, and then iBiblio. Some people here remember this. In fact, at least one person has on a Sunsight t-shirt. Classic, there it is. So during the year, we're going to, in the true nature of iBiblio, which is all collaborative, is bring different people from all different kinds of shared values of information sharing and open source here to speak or to be with you. Today, of course, is Bob Young, who was, you'll hear in a minute, is one of our great benefactors and supporters and creator of several different companies here in this area, many that you've heard of. I've been asked to make a couple of announcements, so I'm going to do those. World Usability Day is November the 8th. That'll be happening at Glaxo. And Jackson Fox is organizing that here. And you can go to the Triangle Usability Group, which is TRIUPA.org. If you're interested in celebrating your computer actually being usable, just like this one. The Science Bloggers Conference, which we're putting on. This is the second North Carolina Science Bloggers Conference. If you're interested in blogging and in science, last year and this year we'll have people from Discovery Channel, from scientists, from New Scientist, from Science Magazine, Science Times, and more importantly, people that blog about science online and scientists that blog about being scientists online. That will be January 19th. iBiblio is one of the premier sponsors of that. And on February the 8th, DJ Spooky, the Subliminal Kid, will be here before he does his world premiere piece at Duke on White Sacks. He'll be here in the afternoon talking to us on that Friday. So you can see the performance at Duke, and you can actually talk to Duke, to Spooky, about how he's using and reusing and remixing and mashing up materials to make new works of art and new experiences, which will include, of course, with Spooky, video and music, among other things. So I have before I introduce Bob, I have a question. How many people here said, yes, I'm attending on the Facebook event for this? Is that 75? Can anybody tell? How many people said maybe? This is my reality test to like see how much you trust the maybe people. The answer is zero.
You had one maybe at the back.
He's thinking, do you really mean maybe? Were you
I
really?
Can't remember. I either said maybe or yes.
Well, I think that is a yes. Okay. How many people saw this by email instead? Okay. Just trying to like get the Facebook vibe here. So, about half, so that's pretty good. How many people saw a poster and came because of that? Okay, no more posters. I hate them anyway. How many people heard it on WNC Radio? Okay, won't waste money on that. Okay, although we didn't really. Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot all for coming. I can't say enough good things about Bob Young. For one thing, for many years, Bob comes and talks to a class of about 20 graduating seniors in information science almost every year. And often he hires one or two of them, even after he's told them that he got where he is by not paying any attention to his teachers, by being a slack student. All these are lies, frankly. Bob just wasn't graded on what he was good at. And Bob is good at learning a lot of things quickly and nimbly and putting them to work. Bob is the founder of Red Hat, the largest and most successful open source company, now market capped at $4 billion. That's B. Since leaving Red Hat, Bob has founded three companies and saved the Canadian Football League from near extinction, BT. The Ticats, you can't tell it by their placement, but you can tell it by their attendance. So the Ticats are now heavily attended for their venue. That's very good since Bob took them over. So people who know Canadian football might know that the Tiger Cats, the original use of the word, the original and longest continuous trademark use of the word tiger in North America. You can remember that, Apple. Bob is also the founder of an on-demand publishing company, Lulu.com, which many of you know well. It's just changed the way publishing has happened pretty drastically in the last little bit. Bob's new company has just moved to Rosemary Street here in Chapel Hill, Lulu.tv, which is a video sharing and distribution operation. Bob is also the founder of an open source media server and player company, Gnack, because Bob has the knack, which many of you will be familiar with. It plays Flash, among other formats. It does not play certain restricted formats, MP3, for example, which is requires a. So Bob has been a friend of Biblio for a long time. It's about 8 years ago or nine that we became iBiblio at Bob's suggestion and with support of his charity, the Center for the Study of Public, Center for the Public Domain. And so we've had a great relationship. Bob is a very animated speaker who I know you'll enjoy, and he has also agreed to take lots of questions. And he may not stand up here, he may stand up there. Where do you want to be?
I'll stand up.
He does stand up here. And so then he can jump into the audience. And you guys have to be ready to get right here. Bob.
Thank you. I suspect, like the rest of you, the only reason I'm here is because I'm a groupie of Paul Jones's. When I met him, he had the long hair. He had to have been a rock band member, so, you know, being a groupie, you know, I followed Paul around. There's actually more to that story than just following Paul around, which is that I'm a typewriter salesman by training. You know how come the revolution, you know, most people who start businesses, they started as lawyers and then they got into business, or maybe as architects and they started a business. So they think of themselves as an architect or an accountant or a lawyer. In my case, come the revolution, I'll be selling you guys Fuller brushes door to door. Only a matter of time. And so to that end, I think of myself, my work with engineers, because all of my businesses have been in the technology sector. I am to engineers what a groupie is to a rock band. You know, what's the point of being a rock musician if you don't have groupies? So, you know, what's the point of being an engineer building great products if you don't have typewriter salesmen to help you convince the world to actually use your great products? And so that's sort of what I'm trying to do. Paul, what am I supposed to be talking about again today?
Well, something about the number 42.
Now, can you guys hear me okay, or should I turn this thing on?
I think that's just for the camera.
Ah.
No, there it goes.
No. Now, is that better
that's
or worse?
Better.
All right. I'll let the audiovisual guys manage the volume levels. Is there an audiovisual guy who manages the volume levels?
It's Chris Duvall, you moved down to Chris.
Because actually, if there is an audiovisual guy who manages the volume levels, then I get to play with his head. Just a
I think he just missed where he was supposed to be.
All right.
I can get this.
No. Or you'll manage the AV.
Yeah.
Okay. Paul, what am I supposed to be talking about?
Okay.
Do you care?
What I told people is, I sent them exactly the verbiage you said, and then I said, he will never say any of this.
Yes.
So you're going to talk about your open source entrepreneurship and what makes entrepreneurs.
Okay.
And you are also...
I thought you'd get there.
Okay, I was actually going to talk a little bit about iGoogly and why what Paul does is important.
How's that?
Testing, one,
level,
two, three,
up, back up.
Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Sorry. I should be telling it, Joe.
Up.
Is that the name of the joke?
Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, let me start a little bit by talking about education, the story that Paul was talking about, as to what I end up telling his class earlier, which is simply that as a student, you really don't actually have to buy into this whole marks thing, because once you leave school, none of your employers will ever actually look at your transcript. So, you know, when you come to school, have a good time. Learn something interesting. Don't learn what these guys tell you, because that's all really boring. And if they knew what they were talking about, you know, they'd all be Bill Gates. Instead of which, they're starving to death here at Chapel Hill. So why are you following their advice as to what knowledge you should learn? And in my case, the reason I was a temporary salesman, where all my friends went off to become lawyers and accountants, was I was the worst student that any of you guys have ever met. And I came by this honestly. My mother before me was the worst student that the world had ever seen. Her claim to fame, and a very funny family story, she literally dined out of this story. So when my father would reprimand us for not doing our homework or not getting good marks, she would console us with her story of she took German literature and German composition 1 year. So you know, it was German she took all year. And the first half was German comp, and the second half was German lit. And she got 0 in German composition, and she got 1 out of 100 in German lit. And her teacher explained to her that the reason she got 1 out of 100 in German lit was she spelled her name correctly on the final exam. So I don't buy this honestly. But the deal is, of course, if you're not going to pay attention to what smart guys like Paul tell you or your other professors, what you do have to do is you do have to learn something of value. Because what you're actually here for, wherever you study, is you're not actually trying to learn a trade, you're learning how to learn. And so, by the time you graduate, you will know absolutely nothing of any value to your career for the rest of your life. What you hopefully will have done is learned how to learn useful things. But even before I go too far along there, I need to find out who you guys are. How many of you actually attend, as in students, of either UNC Chapel Hill or some other academic institution? Okay, I can watch you. Being good students. How many of you guys work for a living? And you can both be a student and work for a living. You can put up your hand both times.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
All right, what about the people who work? How many of you guys work in technology versus work at Starbucks? Too bad. You should get jobs at Starbucks. Much more future in technology. Technology is a terrible career path, by the way. For those of you who think that you're going to make money and build a career in technology, you know, quit today. Go sell life insurance. I'm serious. It's stupidly difficult, and here's why. It is simply because you're going to put in 8 hours a day doing what your boss tells you to do, or maybe what your customers tell you to do. If you're your own boss, it doesn't really matter. Someone's going to be telling you what. And it's going to be a huge amount of work, at least 8 hours a day, sometimes 12 hours a day. And at the end of that day, you get to go home, and you get to, you know, after dinner, get back to work, and you spend another however many hours you can stay up trying to learn enough about the evolution of your industry to be relevant the following day. And that's why those of us in technology, we work stupid hours. And it's also why, I'm pretty much the exception. I think I know about two other guys from early in my career. I started in technology in the late 70s. And there are two other of us who are still in technology. And we all have the same idiosyncrasy, which is that second 8 hours that you put in trying to keep up with the industry is actually why you're in the business. If you see that second 8 hours, those hours you have to put in just to remain competent for tomorrow as a burden, you will burn out and you should be selling life insurance, as all my other friends from the early 80s are doing. They sell life insurance, they are selling real estate, and they all get to go home at 5, and then they get to go play golf, or they play bridge, or they actually have a life of some sort. And if you're in technology, that's the reason you don't want to be in technology. So you will never have a life. You know how your wives or your girlfriends, your husbands, your boyfriends say, come on, dear, you've got to put the iPhone away and actually have a life. You may as well save their breath. Because you never will, as long as you're in technology, because of the rate of change. But here's why this rate of change and why what iBiblio does is sort of A, linked, and B, important. And I'm just going to ramble on for a bit and talk about iBiblio, and then I'm going to ask you guys what you want to know instead of me rambling on sort of talking to you. But the thing, let me back. After we made all this money at Red Hat, Mark Ewing and I sat around saying, what can we do for this greater community of engineers who had helped us be successful at Red Hat? This is 99, fall of 99. And it was sort of at that time, every single open source, because of course Red Hat and then VA Linux and then even Caldera, God bless their evil little hearts. All went public. And so the public markets, the public financial markets, felt that open source free software, Richard Stallman, was the wave of the future. How many of you guys don't know Richard Stallman? Oh, good. Well, then I may ignore you guys. Ask your neighbor, Richard Stallman. You'll understand why it was so bizarre to open Fortune magazine and see Richard Stallman's face looking back at 1999. I mean, just he's the antithesis of what Wall Street stands for. So every single open source project of any value whatsoever was having money thrown at it. And so Mark and I said, well, there's not much point throwing money at open source projects. So we couldn't figure out what to do with, you know, what we should support. And Mark, to his credit, reversed the analysis and said, okay, Bob, if open source fails, why will it fail? And maybe we should fund something that will stop it from failing. So we did that analysis, and the answer, the reason open source was going to fail and yet fail, although much less likely today, particularly the European community seems to get it, some of the South American countries understand it, which is that our legislators, in their infinite wisdom, and this isn't just true in Washington, it's true in Brussels and Tokyo and everywhere else, have equated the future of their economies with the health of their technology sector. Okay, so far so good. They then make the connection of the technology sector counts on patents and copyrights. And as we all know, I don't know about you guys, patents and copyrights are inherently a very good. So they said, okay, if we want to grow our technology sector, because we have to grow our economy, and to get the technology sector to grow, we have to protect intellectual property. Ergo, if some intellectual property is a good thing, so if copyrights 20 years long is a good thing, copyrights 100 years long must be better. If patents of inventions are a good thing, patenting ideas, i.e. software, must be even better. And they came to equate intellectual property protections as any more protections is a good thing. And of course, what they all missed, which is something that all you guys know, but is that intellectual property is an awful lot like vitamin D, intellectual property protections. Too little vitamin D and you'll get rickets, or any medical students here? There must be. What happens when you get too little vitamin D? Is it rickets? I think it's something like rickets. Damn it.
Sounds right.
Thank you. You get rid too much vitamin D will actually kill you. It's actually a poison if you take too much of the stuff. And that's the problem with intellectual property rules. So what Mark and I did is we funded a thing called the Center for the Public Domain. Yeah, and we put $15-20 million into the thing. And we recruited a really talented board. I mean, to this very day, I'm kind of astounded by the guys who stepped up to help us. We had Larry Lessig on our board. We had John Seeley Brown, who ran Xerox PARC, on our board. We had John Gilmore, who started Cygnus Solutions. We had Jamie Boyle, who runs the intellectual property study group over at Duke University's Law School. And really, remarkably talented guys on this board. And I learned in the course of about, because we did this as a venture philanthropy exercise. I don't know how many of you guys pay much attention to philanthropy, but the concept of venture philanthropy is most philanthropy historically has gone into you give, pick a number of millions of dollars to a project, and the project manager, MacArthur Foundation, suddenly spends most of his time managing the money, and then in his spare time he tries to find something useful to do with some of the money. The concept behind venture philanthropy is you give your executive director a chunk of money, and their, his or her mission is to spend that money as fast as they can, so they run it, doing the job we hired them to do. So we got Lori Racine, our executive director. Her mission was not to husband the $20 million we gave her, but to blow through it as quickly as she could. Obviously not blow through it, put it to good use, make it work. And her mission, her mandate, was her job was not to change intellectual property laws. Because we were just a couple of entrepreneurs, we had no idea whether copyrights should in fact be 20 years or whether it should be 100 years. Maybe it should be. But you guys, I don't think so. Just talking about copyrights for a second. I don't know how much time you guys have spent thinking about it. Copyrights were invented by the British Parliament in like 1810, specifically to protect Charles Dickens. If you remember Charles Dickens, Tale of Two Cities, we all knew they hated him in high school. Okay, so Charles Dickens was writing these books, they became very popular. And he was forced to serialize them. If you remember this, they were originally published as a series, as chapters in a series of newsletters or newspapers over a number of weeks. And the reason he had to do that is if he published them as a book, every other printer in England would buy a copy of the book, rush it, stay up all night and print several thousand copies and go into competition with Charles Dickens without asking his permission, without paying anything for it, without compensating. And so the British Parliament correctly realized that this was unfair to Charles Dickens. And if they were going to encourage guys like Charles to write his next book, they had to have sort of a societal deal with him. They said, Charles, we will put the apparatus of the state, Scotland Yard. Who was Scotland Yard way back then? Bobby's, but
I have no idea.
Robert, I'm trying to remember. My English history will come back to me. Sorry?
Bueller.
Robert Peeler. Was the first Bobby.
Oh, yeah, he's the Bobby.
Thank you for that. Anyway, so they put the weight of the apparatus of the state behind protecting Charles Dickens' works and stopping every other printer from printing, and that makes perfect sense. And the deal was that they would protect his work for, I think, 7 years originally. Provided at the end of that 7 years, his work fell into the public domain. And over the years, from there to the end of the Second World War, there was debates of this, and copyright was extended out to 20 years. Seems reasonable, 7 years, 20 years. I'm not sure what the right number of years is, but it's probably in there somewhere. Of course, then Mickey Mouse started falling into the public domain. And you actually had Mickey Mouse amendments. Everyone thinks it was an adjective on these omnibus trading bills, but it actually was the Mickey Mouse amendment. and it was amended, it added another 10 years to the Copyright Act every 10 years or so. And suddenly, copyright, not just for Mickey Mouse, but for everything else on the planet, became 100 years. In the case of an individual, it actually became 50 years plus the lifetime of the individual, assuming you write your equivalent of A Tale of Two Cities when you're 50 years old, and you live another 50 years, that's roughly 100 years. The problem with the concept, as it amuses me, is the deal now, the societal deal, is we will protect your great novel for 50 years. We'll use the FBI and, you know, the NC State Police to protect you and stop people from stealing your story. For 50 years, in order to give you an incentive to write your next book, but that incentive carries on for 50 years after your death.
But you guys, I end up with sort of a logical breakdown of
how do I have an incentive 50 years after I'm dead to write my next book? Anyway, so that's the problem. That's what we're looking at in intellectual property. Patents are the same way. For those of you who paid attention to it, patents, you used to have to deliver your machine, your invention, to the U.S. Patent Office in order to get a patent. I can't remember when it was, but sometime after the Second World War, they ran out of space in their warehouse for the machines that people were trying to back. So they changed the law saying, no, you don't have to deliver your invention to the patent office anymore because we don't have anywhere to store it. You just have to write a description of your invention. And with that very change, they changed what the patent inspector was doing from evaluating an invention as to whether it was patentable to evaluating ideas as to whether they are patentable. Anyway, and the problem is the trend was continuing in that direction. More, you know, technology meant more intellectual property protection. So the whole point of the Center for the Public Domain was to improve the quality of the debate. And it's, I don't know about you guys, at the end of the day, that I'm a big believer in Churchill's view of democracy, which was when someone accosted him and was trying to convince him that democracy could address a terrible way to organize human beings. I mean, we know all of the weird laws, all of the weird public policy that gets thrown out at us in the name of democracy. And Churchill's line was, yeah, democracy, you know, it's really a pretty crappy way of organizing human beings until you consider all the others. And so that's where my faith in democracy comes from. And in order for democracy to work, you got to have public debate. In order to have public debate work, you have to have two sides to the debate, which is why people are funding the creationist side of the Darwin thing. But that's what the Center for the Public Domain's mission was to raise the quality of the debate. So what we get around our table every time we had a meeting is, you know, Larry Lessig or myself or John Gilmore or Mark Ewing or Jamie Boyle would try and come up with something that would make a difference. And eventually, the topic of iBiblio came up. And I was actually the champion. It's interesting in public, it's the thing you like about for-profit businesses as a manager or as an executive over not-for-profit businesses. Not-for-profit businesses is really hard to figure out what the right idea is to get in a for-profit business. If you have three people sitting in a room and you have four people, you come up with four different products. By the end of the year, you launch the four products or the four services, and by the end of the year, you can tell which one in that room was the best businessman because his customers will have bought more of his products than the other three guys will have sold of theirs. There's actually a measurement. There's a score. Whereas in not-for-profit business, much harder to figure out when we're trying to improve the debate on intellectual property legislation, whose idea actually had the biggest impact on that debate. There's no real sort of tangible empirical measurement on the exercise. So we ended up, and this is, I believe, in hindsight, having talked to a lot of other people working in philanthropy or not-for-profit business, this is not an uncommon way of decision-making around your board table. And the decision-making simply goes,
hold on, whose turn was it last time? Okay, whoever's sitting on the left, the minute it's your turn to come up with the good idea. And my good idea was I kill you. It was an interesting debate, and here's simply, you know, to give you the 30-second tour of the debate, was simply that while Iglio wasn't the big idea, it wasn't going to get necessarily the New York Times to come here and write about it. It was the tangible evidence. It was the real-world implementation of a lot of the theory that we talked about around our table. So we talk about the reason there needs to be a public domain, the reason there needs to be fair use in the Copyright Act. And I don't want any of you guys to stop to think about this one as well. Everyone, again, this is the problem that our politicians have with intellectual property rules, is they lose sight of the fact that where is the vast majority of the knowledge that businesses like Red Hat or IBM or even Microsoft, where's the vast majority of the knowledge that they use to serve their customers coming from? And of course, you ask a politician who doesn't really think about it, you say, well, of course it's from their patent and copyright portfolios. And it's not. 99.98% of it, actually there's probably a few more nines, virtually all of it is in the public domain. Virtually all of it. Patents and copyrights are the exception to the rule. They are not the rule. The rule is everything you learned in grade school, everything you guys learn here at Chapel Hill, it's all public knowledge. It's all in the public domain. Our whole society works because we work collaboratively on these things. It's not because we patent things and protect one company, one company's exclusive right to use these ideas. So we get to iBiblio, where it's the concept of, okay, how do we materially, how do we put a stake in the ground and say, when we talk about knowledge being free, the vast majority of the stuff we use is free for public use, where do we point? Well, we can point to the library. I don't know about you guys, the problem the library system has is it has such a 18th century brand associated with it. So how do you update the library? And of course it's the internet. And how do you point at the internet when Google wants to own the world as bad as Microsoft does? I don't know if you guys have noticed that. Google's great accomplishment is not that they've turned, you know, sort of searches into a $1 trillion business at this point. It's that they have succeeded. They are the fastest, not the fastest growing company on the planet, they're the fastest company on the planet to have gone from a brand that said do no evil to a brand that implies the opposite. It took Microsoft 3 years to achieve what Google's done. And I'm astounded by it. I love Google, don't get me wrong. It's just they are now so big and so dominant. They don't themselves understand some of the evil things that they may end up doing. Anyway, so iBiblio, the public piece of public institutions, is essential. If we don't have universities that are funded by all of us, if we don't have elementary schools that are funded by all of us, and if we don't have repositories of knowledge that are funded by all of us, you know, we might mount the barricades in favor of the public domain and of fair use, but we don't have a real-world implementation of it to point at, and that's from Paul Johnson's. So that's my best description, Paul, of your relevance. And not only at Chapel Hill, but around the world. I was in Singapore in 1999, I guess, talking to the Minister of Education for the what is Minister? Singapore. It's a country, but it's more a city-state, isn't it? Yeah. Talking to the Minister of Education there, who was grilling me on open source, and he said, you know, something, some good thing about iBiblio. He goes, oh, that's right. He was asking us where we were. Where was North Carolina in the United States? He was a smart guy, don't get me wrong. He was just trying to remember how to place the states. I say, oh, we're on the East Coast. We're sort of halfway between Boston and Miami, you know, sort of middle. And it's going, okay, yeah, I get it. I said, you know, one of the universities there, I say, UNC Chapel Hill. I said, are they famous for anything? I go, yeah, they had Michael Jordan, he played basketball. Blank, you know, And I said, well, they also host the Sunset Act of Leo.
The guy's face brightens up.
Oh, I'm not a Leo. Oh, that's a really important university. So there you go. You thought you were famous for your basketball. So that's it. With that, I'd rather know what you guys want me to ramble on about rather than me talk. You must have some questions. I can't put you all to sleep. Sure.
What was the hardest part of getting your enterprises sort of off the ground and into real businesses?
The hardest part of getting my enterprises off the ground and turning them into real businesses.
Maybe your first, since now you've got a track record, I'm guessing. Are you a little easier?
No, actually, interesting enough, Lou has been the hardest for a specific reason. My follicle impairment is not a result of age or genetics. It is all a result of Hugh Kalis.
I was wondering when you're going to start picking on me.
I'll make my retirement.
That's right.
The reason I get to pick on Hugh is Hugh, we poached Hugh from the University of North Carolina, and then he left to go back to the University of North Carolina. Which means I get to pick on. So I'm actually very grateful to you for that. So the problem is, I don't have a single answer. There's a million of them. They relate from fundraising. So early in your career, it's always about raising money because you have no credibility. People just don't believe it. Not only do you have no credibility because you haven't done it before, but you have no credibility because you're 26 years old and people look at you and they say, what an idiot, he's only 26 years old. And there's no real way of solving that one. You know, you can grow a beard, you can dye your hair, but you still look 26 years old. The attraction, however, to Hamilton Rentals, which is my first one, Vernon Leasing, and then Red Hat, was all of them, interesting enough, were in the distribution community. So all of them could start doing business literally within a week of opening their door because we would buy things at Vernon Hamilton and then at Vernon. We would buy computers originally from Digital Equipment Company and then later on from Hewlett Packard and IBM. And we could offer those computers to our customers. Of course, it took a lot of time to find the customers and then it took even a longer time to convince them to use your rental service rather than someone else's, but at least you had the opportunity of serving a customer, you know, almost immediately. And as a tech writer salesman, you know, this immediate customer feedback thing is valuable and important. At Lulu, we are actually building an online application. So for the first 2 years, we were building code, putting up a website that no one wanted to use because the damn thing wasn't usable. You know, and every time we got a customer who would come to Lulu and try and publish a book, it wouldn't work. And so we'd sit down with the customer and we'd find out why it wouldn't work. And 6 months later, we have a new version out, and we'd go back to that customer, and meanwhile that customer would have moved to California or whatever. You know, you have to start again and find another customer. So Lulu was the hardest one because we spent literally a solid 2 years doing nothing but that early stage building of infrastructure and user interface. We got it going in 2004, and since then we've been doubling our business every year, so it's very encouraging. And I don't know, there must be some Freudian component to this, because having done Lulu, I'm now working with Bart Davis and the team, Jason among others, and behind you, doing the Gannak Lulu TV project, which is exactly the same problem, where we actually have to build the technology before we can serve it. And that is painful because it takes time and it takes a vision, it takes a commitment that being in the distribution game where you get to go and buy someone's product and sell it doesn't take because you can get that immediate feedback. Whereas with something like Gannak, it's going to be 6 months from now and 6 months out of Jason's life before he's going to have any idea whether he didn't just waste that last 6 months. And you should go to work for Hugh over at the university here to get a nice table job. or whether in fact it was worth doing. So there's a million more of these. I don't know where you want me to start, but they're all difficult. The rule is, by the way, it is the same thing as being a student, going back to my original point, which is to be a successful entrepreneur, it's all about learning. To be a successful anything in this life, it's all about learning. It's how well you are able to learn the next thing. So the fact that I'm one of the world's one of the worst students was a bizarre sort of competitive advantage in my training. It's one of the reasons why I'm mean to professors and teachers at every opportunity. Because now imagine, you know, you're in grade one, and you're all excited because you just graduated kindergarten, and they're now giving you grades, and they post the grades on the door. So, and you rush up to see what your grade was, because you're a competitive kid, you grew up in a family of boys. There they're listed alphabetically. I mean, they must be. The Youngs are at the bottom. Okay, that's my joke, because the Young was at the bottom of every listed grade I ever had sort of in my whole graduate. So your first year teacher, you know, you struggle through, and then, you know, sort of as you get to the end of the year, she has a meeting with the grade two teacher, who wants to know what are the kids like who are coming to my class. And the grade two teacher, then the grade one teacher says, oh, you know, well, Susie, she's brilliant, we'll love Susie, and we'll go through the list and go, you know, Bob's a nice enough guy, but, you know, he's not too bright. And have that happen to you 16 years in a row. And by the time you graduate, you know that every single person you graduated with is smarter than you are. So it's actually a hugely motivating element. You know, I actually had a teacher come up to me the other day and try and apologize to me on behalf of teachers everywhere for having treated me so bad. And I refused to accept the apology, because without that motivation, who knows? I too might be running out of wheels.
We could try this. We could trade off for a little while. You could take my paycheck, and I could, well, I'll just go down to Hilton Head.
Actually, I bet he remembers this one. My paycheck, this is, mind you, thanks to my success at Red Hat, but my paycheck at Lulu is only sufficient to qualify me for the health plan at Lulu. So no, you wouldn't actually like my paycheck.
It's not much difference.
Other questions?
Do you care to share your take on the commitment or the love that one has to have in doing the work that you do in order to do whatever it is you do? The reason I say that is you mentioned early on how don't get in the technology field, you're going to be working endless hours, but yeah. If the work is really play, isn't that a driving force? Isn't that a really good reason to do whatever it is you do?
That's actually a very good point. And another sort of thing that came up from a talk I gave recently, and I was, someone phrased that slightly differently, but it was along the lines of, you know, sort of, do you love what you're doing? How are you able to do it and keep up that effort? And a woman in the audience said, it's because he has a supportive wife. This woman didn't know him. She just made that assumption. I just actually stopped and get it. So the first answer to your question is, at least in my case, and I suspect it's true for all of us, is that if you're going to work 16 hours a day, make sure that whoever your spouse is, or your significant other, or your support groups, understand that they are more important to you than your work. Rule number one, at all times, your family is always more important to you than your work. You are going to have to work 16 hours a day, and there will be weeks, months, where you don't see your family but for a couple hours a day. But you've got to somehow figure out how to convince them that it is, that you genuinely understand that they are more important to you than your work. Because too many business guys fail to do that. Their families are more important to them than their work. They forget to make the effort to communicate it. And, you know, 10 years later, they're usually successful, and, you know, their wife has run off with the gardener or whatever. I mean, the point is, they haven't set their priorities in their own life. So if you're referring to love, love relates to other people as opposed to what you do. Because we don't love what we do. We don't love things, we love people.
We can confuse ourselves into thinking that we love things because the things do things for people that actually is important. So I love open source and Linux, not because I love electronic bits and bytes that don't hug me back at me, but because open source and Linux enables me to empower a whole sort of generation of technology users that, you know, the Microsofts and the Oracles of this world weren't prepared to do. And it also enabled me to pay the mortgage and, you know, have my wife like me at the end of the day. But coming all the way back to this, if you're going to start your own business, or if you're going to get into technology in particular, I can't reinforce the point you're making strongly enough. You had better actually enjoy what you're doing, because you'll burn out. People who burn out are people who force themselves to do things that they don't enjoy just for the money. And you know, I could give you all the platitudes in the world about money being the root of all evil, but I mean, that's kind of where it starts. So you can't force yourself to do things for money. You have to do it because you're passionate about it.
Sure. As part of your discussion, what have you been discussing about the length of patents? Where would you and your fellow philanthropists like patents to go, and different links for different kinds of patents? And related to that, what about patents whose research money at least partially came from public funds?
Okay. That's a really long question, and you're going to have to get a much smarter guy on the topic of patents to go there, but I'll give you my 30 seconds on it. I don't have any problems with 20-year patents. I think there probably should be a two-tier patent process, because there are some things that shouldn't get 20-year patents. Some technology, for example. And you start looking at copyrights. For example, if Microsoft, back when they invented DOS, had gotten a patent instead of just copyrighted DOS, DOS today would still be, when did DOS quit being used? 95 was when Windows came out, roughly. It's still actually embedded in a lot of Windows. But basically, the DOS you were using in 1994 would still be subject to a patent for another 6 years, even though no one on the planet is using DOS. So why would the patent extend? It's actually worse with copyrights, because of course Microsoft now has a copyright on DOS that lasts until the year 2090. Just stupid, you know. So we should be limiting patents and copyrights. The thing I do feel strongly about is patents should be limited to inventions and not to ideas. So one-click shopping is the world's stupidest patent, because it was designed around an idea. It maybe get a patent around a particular implementation of one-click shopping, but there's an infinite number of ways you're programming one-click shopping. So it's a stupid patent, no matter how you look at it, if the patent system worked properly, which it doesn't, because it now is awarded around ideas. Copyrights is my bugbear. Things that were written in, you know, whatever, 1920 are still subject to copyright, despite the fact that they haven't been published. They haven't been available for 80 years. And they're still. So what it's done is put a chill on any archival. So if you find a great old book from 1920 that hasn't been published for 80 years, and you republish it, or you want to use excerpts from it, you cannot. Because you have to assume that someone will come out of the woodwork and demand all of your money for the work you're doing around this book, or this idea, or this poem, or these songs, even though no one's using them, even though they haven't been used for 70 years. It's just stupid. So copyrights should be maybe 20 years long, and then you can have a renewal. So for Mickey Mouse, copyright should be 20 years, and then Disney Corporation can renew that copyright several times if they want. But you know, making copyright 100 years for everything is just dumb. Sorry, you had a question.
Well, I was wondering what specifically was about you that seemed to have made you such a poor student. And then did that characteristic really directly help you with
So the question was, what particular things made me a bad student, and did that characteristic help me with Red Hat? And I think the answer is yes to the second one. What made me a bad student? Well, my daughter describes it this way. She came into my office a few years ago, she was in high school. And you know, she was trying to ask me a question, and I was saying, well, that's a pretty blouse. And, you know, how are you doing in school? And anything but answering the question. She finally stopped me. Bob, because of course she calls me Bob and she's mad at me, which she calls me Bob a lot because she's a 20-year-old daughter, but her line was I had the worst case of ADD of anyone in her high school, was her attitude. So had there been Ritalin back when I was a kid, I too could have gone to UNC Chapel. how it helped me with Red Hat is, you know, I make joke about the fact that being the worst kid in my class meant I came out of school knowing that I had to work harder than everyone else because they were all smarter than me. That's the benefit of being a bad student. What caused me to be a bad student, I just daydreamed. I had very little self-discipline, I think it was. Maybe it was ADD, I don't know. Sorry. I can't tell you, you know, remember the old Horatio Alger stories, you know, from the turn of the previous century, where, you know, the guy by working hard and trying hard to build him up from his bootstraps, that's probably the thing that we all have in common. You know, so any of us who develop into good public speakers, you know, like Paul here, do so not because we're born good public speakers, but because we get lots of practice. And the same thing is true for anything you will ever do. You know, the best example I had of that was, again, I hate to quote my daughters too much, but the three of them were, when we first arrived in North Carolina, we moved down here just in time for Hurricane Frank. We moved into our new house, and literally a week later, all the trees in our whole neighborhood had fallen down. And we couldn't go anywhere for a solid week until they moved some of these trees. It was one of these new neighborhoods with a big old pine trees that, and they wiped out the forest and just left a few trees standing, and then they wondered why, when there was a windstorm, all the trees fell over. Great urban planning. Anyway, so, you know, we were trying to keep them busy because we'd left all their friends behind, and we enrolled them into swimming programs for the summer, and so they'd never been in a competitive swimming program. How many of you guys have been in competitive swimming programs? I tell you, in North Carolina, it's like this cult. Because our kids would be in the swimming program, they would swim their little hearts out, and they'd be lapped in the pool by each other. I was just astounded. And this was not like, you know, sort of some elite swimming program. This is a neighborhood swimming program swimming against each other. Anyway, so they did this for a full summer until sort of late August. And at the end of August, I went up to visit, as a family, we went up to visit my brother in Canada, and they had a regatta at their cottage. And so all the kids, you know, they had swimming races for their kids. And my three daughters, who came last in every single race they did in North Carolina, went up there and won every race they had to win. And what they didn't realize was this whole summer of Nancy, you know, pushing them into the pool and making them swim competitively, all the kids they were swimming against kept getting better, so they didn't notice that they had been getting better. Until they went out to my brother's regatta and suddenly realized, holy cow, we can actually swim. It's not just the people in North Carolina who swim like fish. Anyway, so perseverance, hard work, just Horatio, feed them old Horatio Alger stories. Sure.
What was the process? How did it come about that you moved from employee?
there's a different story for every single entrepreneur you will ever meet. So there is no one path. Someone's going to write a book on it, and they'll figure out the six magic character traits that all entrepreneurs have to have. Maybe. I'm not the academic, so I haven't written the book, and I can't tell you. All I know is every time I talk to an entrepreneur, his story is very different than mine. The only common ones is, as I say, is that they typically come from a remarkably, and of course, all these rules have exceptions, but most of us come from some sort of very supportive family or friend environment so that we have a life. And as a result, we can afford to focus on our passion or our whatever. And we're stupid enough to work really hard at it. And we typically work really hard at it because we actually enjoy what we're doing. So it's not really work at all. You know, our choice is playing golf or building another company. I'd much rather build another company than play golf. Sure, it was, yeah, at the back.
Part of the lore of the American enterprise system and the interface with venture capital is that almost everybody who has had a major success or two in free enterprise has some early failures.
Yes.
And they need to acknowledge yes. And what did you learn from it?
No failures. my favorite failure is the first incarnation of what became Red Hat. No, that was my favorite, two failures. I had two in a row. So let me talk about the two of them very briefly, and then Paul, I think we have to move on. So the two failures were one, Vernon Computer Rentals was doing pretty well. One of the things that we had done really well, much better than we realized that we had done, is if you're going to be in the computer finance business, you need people to lend you money to buy the next computer to look after the next customer. So, for those of you who know anything about balance sheets, what you're trying to do is increase your debt equity ratio. Get more debt on top of whatever amount of equity you had, because the more money you borrowed, the more customers you could look after, because you borrowed money to buy a $10,000 computer for the next customer, and then you got another customer, so you need another $10,000 and then another customer. So trying to convince the banks to lend you money was, turns out, we were really good at it. And by 1989, we had gotten our debt equity ratio up to 9-1 on an electronic inventory. I don't know how many of you guys have talked to banks, but try and get a bank to lend you 1-1 today against electronic inventories, you'll have done well. 9-1, as it turns out at the time, was unheard of. And we ran into the 1990 recession. We were actually headquartered up in Toronto. The Canadian banks all panicked because free trade was coming in. It's a long, shaggy dog story. So they called our loan. We sold the business reasonably well. The new buyer, though, bought out all my other shareholders, but insisted that I invest more money in stock options, or what he called, so this is a debt routine. And then, so I converted all of my equity into Vernon into his company stock, and then his company stock went down the tube. And I managed, in the course of about 6 months, to take my net worth from, I don't know where it was supposed to have been, a couple of $1 million, down to something below what it was when I left college 17 years earlier. So that was kind of painful. So I was working out of my wife's sewing closet, and my mission was, I've been cozying up to the Unix workstation, user groups, in New York and Boston and Washington. So these are all the engineers who were sysadmins who were deploying Sun Microsystems and Apollo and IBM RS 6000 machines. And all the people who were supporting these would, you know, gather together in user group meetings. And I was hanging out there initially because I was still with Vernon and I was trying to convince them to rent equipment from me, but then I was suddenly unemployed, so I go, you know what I should do? I should turn the little newsletter that I'm doing for this user group into a magazine. And I will sell East Coast technology users to West Coast technology advertisers. And that was what I founded, a little company called ACC. ACC, no relationship to Atlantic Coast Conference. It was a Connecticut computer company. was the inspiration for ACC. So anyway, I started ACC in my wife's own closet. And in the course of about 6 months, I learned everything I didn't want to know about the publishing business. And I was about to go out of business. I had no money. The publishing business, especially with one title, we were doing a thing called New York Unix Magazine. We also did the Linux Journal. How many of you guys know the Linux Journal? How many of you guys know that if you get either edition one or edition two of the Linux Journal, you will find my name on the letterhead as the publisher? Good work, Dave. my name was the publisher, and the address, the publishing address, was 136 Riverside Avenue, which happened to be my wife's sewing closet. And so that crashed and burned as well. So I had two crashes and burns in literally like a year. The only good thing about the second one is as it crashed and burned, I stopped and go, okay, what am I going to do with this? People are expecting to get another one of my newsletters. I can't afford to put out another newsletter. Meanwhile, I have 5,000 New York Unix mailing list, and I had 10,000 people who signed up to the Linux Journal. This is 1994. And you go, okay, what do you do with 15,000 technology users? It's my only asset. Well, it turns out what most of the mail order, technology mail order companies started as technology magazines. Because that mailing list is, in fact, of great value. So instead of putting out another issue of the Linux Journal or New York Unix, I put out a little catalog called ACC PC Unix and Linux PC Unix and Linux Bookstore. And we did this on the internet. I spammed all the comp.os.linux mailing news groups with the online version of the catalog, and I mailed it to all my offline versions. And it turns out no one wanted anything in my catalog. I was doing all the Unix stuff, so I was doing, you know, AT&T's, actually, I guess, was it Novell already by 94?
I don't think Novell had it.
Novell Unix, was it still AT&T sort of Unix for the PC? SCO did a Unix for the PC. I had Mark Williams Company Unix. I had, you know, various databases for Linux. And I had Slackware and Yggdrasil. And while no one wanted any of the Unix stuff, the Slackware and the Yggdrasil stuff just flew off the shelves. And I went from, you know, crying in my soup to actually having a little business. And from that little business, I realized that, holy cow, if this thing actually succeeds, the problem is I'm going to be out competing against all the real catalog companies and against CompUSA. So we realized we had to get into, we needed a brand. And Mark Ewing, so I'll tell this story and then we got around. So I contacted Mark Ewing because it was a small community in the Linux world at this time. So we all knew each other, and I called him and said, Mark, do you need any help selling your Red Hat Linux thing? So we go back and forth a little bit. I managed to establish that, yeah, he wanted some help. He wanted me to distribute his Red Hat Linux for him. So we start talking, how many copies? I go, well, you know, I've got a couple of customers who really like your beta version. And if your beta version, you know, if Mark was a Carnegie Mellon engineer, whereas most of the other Linux distributions were being built by hobbyists, Mark actually knew what he was trying to do with this. So I say, Mark, you know, if you really have a better Linux distribution, I should be able to switch sell about, you know, 10% of my Slackware Yggdrasil users over to Red Hat. I was selling about 1,000 copies of Slackware and Yggdrasil a month at that time. So I say, Mark, you know, send me 90 days supply, send me 300 copies of you know, your Red Hat release. Dead silence at the end of the phone. I finally get a Mark that he was only thinking of manufacturing 300 copies. Well, I knew how little I was paying for these things. I knew if Mark was only going to sell 300 copies of Red Hat at $20 a copy for 3 months, he was starving to death. So it was sort of a match made in heaven. He needed someone to help him with the marketing and financing thing. I needed a brand and a technology partner. And so the failure of Vernon and then the failure of New York Unix resulted directly in the success of Red Team. So it's all about perseverance. It's all about being too stupid enough to know that you were beaten. And you just keep trying the next time. With that, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Bob, and thank all of you guys for coming. You'll see on the FWO Tongue page the events that are coming up, the blogger. Science Bloggers Conference in January, DJ Spooky in February.
Thank you.
The World Usability Day, November the 8th. And one of the things that we do plan for the spring that several people have asked me about already is an open source entrepreneurs roundtable. So if you're an open source entrepreneur and want to talk to me about that, get in touch. Or if you have open source entrepreneurs you would like to see at this roundtable, let me know. I've had a couple of people already contact me, and I know there was some early interest at the Carolina Technology Consultants about this too. So Aaron Ferguson and Mike Heeman have already said they're interested. Let us know and we'll get to you. And there will be a couple of other events if we can work out something with the Carolina Union Activities Board.
It's new.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. And we'll see you soon.